welcome back, my friends, to Power Hour Nation, one of the driving points in the movement of truth, to find out truths about all the great things. And we were talking off air with my guest and, you know, probably doing a Reader's Digest about many of the things we've spoken about on this radio program, because that's what it's all about, is breaking down the barriers, acquiring facts and information, presenting it to a broad audience, passing it around, and changing the narrative of the culprits who get away with these things time and time again. And with the new one that we're buried in now, it's almost like there's a giant wall about all the ones in the past that they're just not significant anymore, because everyone's afraid of the great COVID monster is going to come bite me when I sleep. And their minds are completely closed to any sort of rational thinking or analysis of data. But we're very blessed. My webmaster ran into our guest, David Misswinkle, and he's a lawyer, and he is taking on one of those giant, giant mysteries, 9/11. He's with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and we need an inquiry. We need justice. The whole world was turned upside down. A city was turned inside out, and many, many people died. They should have had a long and satisfactory life. And somehow, the perpetrators just dust their hands from the dirt and walk away. That's intolerable. Absolutely intolerable. Welcome, David. Tell us something about yourself and your organization, and we'll start our inquiry.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. My name is David Misswinkle. I'm the president, executive director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and we're a nonprofit organization dedicated to government transparency and accountability regarding the crimes of 9/11. You can locate our website at lc4for911.org, and you can see some of the work we've done. I'm a previous college administrator for a little while. I was a police officer for a long time, retired, and I was a criminal defense attorney for quite a while. Now I'm the, as I said, the president and executive director of this nonprofit organization.
Well, that's fantastic, because this is what we need. We can never let them get away with it. Many, many locations, jurisdictions have, you know, those old case squads to go after things with newer techniques and abilities, and sometimes it's because the power structure that was around before isn't there anymore to put up a brick wall to prevent you from getting places. Unfortunately, this one just seems to be reborn all the time, and it is still active, moving from plot to plot, devious action to devious action, and many of the players have probably been promoted and put into higher positions of authority to block, conceal, and make an inquiry like yours difficult. But let's take us back to 9/11 and what your organization is seeing as the main problems to bring to light.
Right. Well, what we've done, two very significant things we've done recently. We've done a number of them, but I would say that two of them that are should really be looked at is, and before I go into that, I should just remind us all that the crimes of 9/11 were many. If we think lots of times of the high rises in New York City, but then lots of times we forget about the Pentagon being attacked, and we forget about the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania or whatever happened in Pennsylvania. But what we were concentrating on originally when we established ourselves was the high rises in, and there were three major buildings that were sensationally brought down. And most people know about the Twin Towers, but they don't know about Building 7. And that was a giant in itself. It was 610 feet tall, 47 stories. It would have been at that time the biggest building in 33 states. It came down, but it wasn't hit by an airplane. It had simple office fires. So when the government explanation of how these buildings came down was that an airplane hit it, caused the fire, and the fire melted the steel, and the steel just started collapsing, and it came down. Up to that day, no steel-structured high-rise ever collapsed because of fire. And the simple reason is that if you, the 4th of July coming up, and you're going to cook your hot dogs outside, and you have your grill, you're going to put the hot dog on the grill, and that grill is going to withstand the flame, and you're going to be able to eat your hot dog, right? Your steel doesn't melt, or the metal doesn't melt, the iron doesn't melt, unless it has about 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit, and it starts to melt. The hottest the buildings came, the towers, with even with jet fuel in them, was probably about 1,700, 1,800. In other words, you need another 1,000 degrees just to start melting the steel. And Building 7, which came down, as I said, without being hit by an airplane, those office fires are probably no hotter than 500, 700 degrees. So you need another 2,000 degrees. So the question is, then how did the buildings come down? What we've done is we've given to the U.S. attorney in the Southern District, at that time was Berman, Jeffrey Berman, a petition with numerous exhibits that are dispositive of controlled demolition bombs and explosives in the buildings. And that includes statements from approximately 120 firemen that those statements were never read into the 9/11 Commission report, where they talked about bombs and explosives. And it also included a peer review paper by prestigious scientists that studied four dust samples from the site. And they found in those dust samples nanothermite. They found red-grade chips. Nanothermite is a high-grade military explosive. The official 9/11 commission in the word NIST, which is, was designated to do the investigation, that's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, they never looked for explosives. They were asked why, and they said, well, nobody asked us to, which is ludicrous because that's a common theme that you would do. All firemen and fire departments, police departments, in something as catastrophic as 9/11 would be instantly looking at the sources and possibly as for explosives. So other exhibits we have in there that were given to the U.S. attorney was, for example, a seismic report. Now, you're all aware of the airplane supposedly hitting the building, but you're not aware that right before the airplanes hit the building, there was explosions in the basement. We know that because the expert has studied the seismic report and can see the explosiveness in the basement prior to the plane hitting. Just seconds prior, the timing was off in both buildings. And there's explosions too in the buildings right before they descend and, you know, totally collapse at near free fall. So that's some of the evidence that was presented. It's numerous evidence, a lot of statements from people like or videos like from like Willie Rodriguez. I don't know if you're familiar with Willie Rodriguez. He was a janitor. He was actually in charge of the janitorial services in the North Tower, and he rescued, he assisted the fire department, rescued hundreds of people. And he says that he was in his, there were six cellars or basement areas in those buildings. He was in the first one down, and there was a massive explosion down in the building. And a guy comes running up to his floor from the basement below, and his skin is peeled off his body, off his arm and his face. And Willie gets him out of the building and proceeds to saves him and proceeds to do save a lot of other people. And then he's the last one out of the North Towers. He's coming down. He dives under a fire engine and is buried for 2 hours. Fortunately, firemen saw him, and they took him out. Well, he testified at the 9/11 Commission in reference to what he experienced, that is, explosions in the basement prior to the plane hitting. and his testimony was blacked out. And I was never given. So that's one of the areas we have on that. I don't know, George, if you have any questions there. And then there's another area that we just completed and gave to the Congress a petition on anthrax, which is interesting. And it might tie into what we're experiencing now, because anthrax is a bioweapon that was sent out to people, at mostly news people at that time, right after 9/11. And in particular, two U.S. senators, Daxel and Leahy, received anthrax, which was 10 times stronger than anything the United States had ever seen before. And on 1 gram would be a million spores. A trillion spores. So think of that. A trillion spores on 1 gram. So maybe you have some questions for me, George, and I'll go on. I don't want to just hog all the time up here.
Oh, no. This is a trip down memory lane, and you're very well researched. From some of my notes, I noticed that the person who was appointed director of NIST by George W. Bush in October 2001, Arden Bement, was the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, former director of DARPA's Office of Material Science, and a former executive at a company called TRW. And TRW had a long collaboration with NASA laboratories in the development of energetic materials that are components of advanced propellants like nano-gelled explosive materials. TRW Aeronautics also made fireproof composites and high-performance elastomer formulations and worked with NASA to make energetic aerosols. Bement was a professor at Purdue and MIT, has a thriving program for nanothermites, and interestingly, at MIT's Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology, we find Martin Z. Bazant, son of notable conspiracy debunker Zenick P. Bazant, who does research on granular flows and the electrochemical interactions of silicon. Bazant is interested in nanocomposites as well and how they relate to naval warfare. MIT was represented at nano energetics conferences in early 1998. Bement was also director at both Battelle and the Lord Corporation. Battelle, where anthrax was made, is an organization of experts in fundamental technologies from the five national laboratories we manage or co-manage for the Department of Energy. Battelle advertises their specialization in nanocomposite coatings. The Lord Corporation also makes high-tech coatings for military applications. In 1999, Lord Corporation was working with the Army and NASA on advanced polymer composites, advanced metals, multifunctional materials. So he was very experienced in all that sort of nanomaterials, but for somehow, as a director, he couldn't connect the dots to say...
Well, the engineers that were in charge, it seemed to be at least the front men, was a guy named Shun Sundar and John Gross. So what you're saying, that director had that type of background, certainly NIST knew about nanothermite. I mean, they worked with it, as you just read. And to the public, it would be a mystery. They hadn't really heard about it at that time. But these secret shops, basically, these, you know, like the CIA, et cetera, like that, or DARPA, they would be really familiar with this kind of stuff. So you're right that it should have been right away looked at as a possible explosive. See, when you look at the buildings come down, and Building 7, NIST had to change their report because a physicist named David Chandler, he studied the fall, the descent, and he measured three falls for 2.5 seconds, which means there's nothing under the building. But 2.5 seconds over 100 feet, 8 floors, were coming down. Nothing was under them. And then it started to, you know, hit what was below it. The buildings and skyscrapers are built from, you know, from the bottom up, and it's hard to knock them down from the top, you know. And how you have to do that is you have to take out the bottom. You know, you have to take out the support columns. And for all the support columns for Building 7 to be removed at one time, in order for the building to fall at free fall, the only way you could do that is not by fire, as the official story is. It's by explosions. You have to explode it out. You have to, you know, have to use controlled demolition. So that's fairly obvious. I mean, if people would look at or relook at those instructions, common sense would tell you that something is going on, like an explosion. You know, you actually see it in the two towers. You can see the squibs coming out. Now, the two towers came down at near free fall, so they didn't come down quite as quick as Building 7, but they came down almost as quick. And when they're coming down, there's girders being sent out, you know, 100 yards to the side horizontally. Buildings don't explode horizontally or come down horizontally. If they came down, it would come down straight, right? It's blowing out. And if you look at some of the film of North Tower and South Tower, it almost looks like a, you know, volcano just went off. I mean, it's a mysterious explosion, okay? And not as elementary as the government tried to say, that it was jet fuel that caused office fires that caused the buildings to go down. That's the two towers. They couldn't use the jet fuel in Building 7. See, something may have happened there to screw the operation up. And because I don't know if you're familiar, George, with Barry Jennings, but Barry Jennings was a head of housing in New York City, and he was in the emergency management team. And on the 23rd floor, Giuliani had put a bunker up there, a security bunker. And him and Michael Hess, who was the city attorney, they rushed there when the buildings were getting hit by airplanes. And when they got there, a little after 9 o'clock, I believe both buildings had been hit by airplanes. There was nobody there. And they go, so what's going on here? And there were sandwiches there that were half eaten and coffee that was still smoking. So they made some calls. They said, get out of there, get out of there. So they decided they better get out of there quick. And they taken the fire escapes down. And then around the eighth floor, there's a big explosion in the building. And this is the early morning. This is like before 9:30 in the morning. Now, two buildings have been hit. They're trying to leave Building 7, and there's a big explosion in the building. And it knocks out the stairway. And Barry Jennings is basically hanging there. He pulls himself up. Eventually, they break out a window with a fire extinguisher and get some help. They think they're going to get some help. Help starts coming towards them, and all of a sudden it runs away. About an hour later, help coming towards them again, and it runs away. And they guess, what's going on? Meanwhile, there's explosions in that building. So finally, they're rescued, and they're told, Barry Jennings said, not look down. They're going through a lobby they had gone up before, and they didn't recognize it. It was like a war zone. And Barry Jennings says he felt like he was walking over dead bodies. But what happens is that when he thought they were going to be rescued and all of a sudden they disappear, is that they were going to be rescued, but the South Tower came down. And as the South Tower came down, they ran away. And then they were going to be rescued a second time. The North Tower comes down, and they run away. So finally they get him out of there, and he makes statements, you know, to the media about the explosions in the building. Now, the government really acknowledges that there was explosions in the building. And it took them, like, over 7 years to do their report. And a few days before the report is released, Barry Jennings mysteriously dies. So it's not really clear how he died. It's my opinion. It's very mysterious. But he was a key witness, an eyewitness to explosives in the Building 7, and the public, of course, doesn't know that. I don't know if you knew that. Are you familiar? Yeah, I guess you are not familiar with Barry Jennings. Yeah, it's very serious, you know, that experience these things. So there's indication that there, you know, maybe there was, when one of the buildings were going to go down, they wanted Building 7 to come down with them. Eventually, this is what happens. Jane Stanley from the BBC, she's a reporter. She's in New York City, and she's live. And the skyline of New York is behind her. And she gets, she's on the phone with London. And London is saying, we understand that another building has gone down. And that's, you know, that's Building 7. And she says, yes, that's true. It has gone down. And the problem with that is that it's still standing behind her. It doesn't go down for another 21 minutes or so. So it goes down around 5:20 in the evening. Right? These explosions originally happened around that, a little after 9 o'clock, or even before 9:30, that Barry Jennings was talking about. During that day, people were saying that they'd heard explosions in the building, and then they were predicting that was going to come down. And you have to realize that a steel structure building has never come down because of fires. So they're waiting, and there was some pre-knowledge that this building was going to come down, and it comes down. Now, that in itself, if, you know, there was no 9/11, and a building of that size, 610 feet, 47 stories, comes down with only office fires that aren't so, they weren't that severe on a few floors. That is major news everywhere in the world. And all your building codes would be changed because there's certainly something defective. Well, the building codes weren't changed. And the reason the building came down is those who already know why it came down. It came down because it was exploded. And it was brought down through controlled demolition. Now, that's part of what our grand jury petition in New York City is about. We want, for the first time, the public to see the evidence that we have. Now, your viewers can get that evidence. We have the exhibits right on our website. So if they go to LC4FOR911.org, they should be able to pull the exhibits out. Just put the grand jury petition and see, or New York grand jury lawsuit, and there's a petition. And you can get the exhibit index and read right off it, and then you can go hear the firemen's or read the firemen's statements and listen to some of the videos and stuff.
Indeed, we'll be back after the break. Thanks for coming out.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Hi, this is Power Hour J. We've been spring cleaning at the Power Mall. We have an overstock of Grown by Nature supplements, and we'd like to offer you 25% off of select products. Hurry, the sale will only be available while supplies last. No code necessary to shop at thepowermall.com, or you can call J at 877-817-9829. That's thepowermall.com or 877-817-9829.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with olive oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that olive oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. We have a big treat to go down memory lane, a lane with bad memories, but with the good cops trying to chase the villains back to the prison cell. And this is the head of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, David Misswinkle. And we sometimes always have great conversations off air, and it's a shame maybe we should record them all and make like a bumper show or something like that. Every once in a while, because we cover some great material, once we get wound up, and we'll put it in replay mode as best we can, because so many of these conspiracies are related, and the plan is pretty much the same. Like, we were in policing for a long time sometimes. Like, it's the same things happen over and over and over again. You just change the names and the dates for who's doing it, because there's only so many ways to skin a cat, as they say. And you see the modus operandi, you know who's doing it. You know how it's being done. You can just smell it as you acquire skills in these regards. And, we were talking a bit about Oklahoma City and that being a dry run for 9/11. And in a way it is. Another bizarre thing that happened here in Canada after Oklahoma City. And it started out as, just like a tidal wave for the news, because they thought they grabbed the thing. Because remember, after Oklahoma City, well, we have to get after patriots. We hate patriots. We hate constitutionalists. We hate this. We hate that. Because they're trying to imply that people who actually believe in the fundamentals of justice, the basics of government, and who may lean a little bit to the cross, are somehow enemies of the state, and they're the ones who perpetrate these great crimes. So in a small little town in British Columbia, Canada, they arrested what they thought was a militia group from the United States with a couple of metric tons of explosives stored in a trailer park in a small community called Smithers, British Columbia. And they were in possession of fully automatic firearms. The media up here just went absolutely ballistic to scream, to yell, to follow the narrative. And then they got called off instantly by saying, no, not yet, too soon. Because after consultation with U.S. Justice Department officials, all these so-called perpetrators were released, given their stuff back, and sent south of the border. Because what were they? They were the next contingent of actors to come on the global stage to do something, and they were preparing in this small community. And ironically, as funny as it could be, I met, because it was the RCMP who were involved in that discovery and cleanup, and unfortunately cover-up by the government after that. But ironically, a friend of mine in Toronto was a school teacher and had a friend who was a Mountie. And then usually, like in the Soviet Union days, when you do something good, you get transferred to Siberia. So she was sent to the Northwest Territories. And she was one of the Mounties who was in Smithers, B.C. at the time. So I was just happening to mention that to the school teacher when her friend walks in the door to come and greet her. She goes, Smithers? Oh, yeah, I used to work at Smithers. And we're like, what are the odds that that could happen? And then I met another chap who was one of the executive officers in the RCMP responsible for that area of that included Smithers, B.C. as well. So it's a small world, but the crimes are great. And the way they do it is great. And the way, they train their patsies, prepare their equipment, acquire their explosives is just, it's mind-boggling. I wish more people understood the pattern, because you could do things about it. Here in Toronto, we had an incident like that when I was on Toronto radio. One of my listeners saw something going down at the docks. He says, George, you've got to get down there. This is just unbelievable. There's a suburban convention down there, a big ship. They're offloading stuff. Everybody's armed. Like, it's just, it's You know, they're not filming a movie. This is the real deal. So I go down there, have a quick peek. Instantly, choom, you're picked up. They're chasing you down the road. And, you know, who are you? What are you doing there? But I'm all dressed up in a nice suit. I pull in the yacht club. They think, you know, I'm just a lawyer going to play with my boat or something like that. And that's the end of it. And I figure, okay, he's right. Something is going on down there. So I go back late at night. Darken myself up, black stuff on my face, hop a fence, crawl across a field, get close, and just start watching for a while. Truck after truck after truck after truck after truck is going to this ship and going downtown. And then finally, an army truck comes. And you got to obey the rules, right? You got to have the explosives logo on the back of your trailer because that's the law. What are they doing with explosives? And why are they taking them downtown? So I follow the truck, and it was going downtown. But it's 3, 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and it's like, we got every red light. And then after a while, we're the only two vehicles on the road. Somebody in the truck's looking down at me. Who's this guy? You know, and it's like, psh, light turns green, I'm out of here. But I know what's going on. You can smell it. You can smell it like a fire in an outhouse. There's just that odor. So how do you break it up? I just go on late-night talk radio. Talk about the global warming anti-convention with all the suburbans and asking people to go down and complain and look and raise hell. And they had to shut it down. We blew their cover. But what happened 30 days later? They arrest a whole bunch of young fellas, what they called the Toronto 18, for planning to put an ANFO device outside a building in downtown Toronto. I know that trick. They did that in Oklahoma City. I know it very, very well. And what would have happened if we had Islamic terrorism here in Toronto, where all the beautiful liberals are? Well, maybe Prime Minister Chrétien would be pressured beyond belief to join the coalition and go to war in Iraq. That's how they do it. And what used to be across the street was the ferry that went to Rochester. And I'd always wondered, like, nothing against Rochester, but what do we need a ferry service to go to Rochester? Niagara Falls. Okay, I can understand Niagara Falls, but Rochester? Well, how do you bring all the American troops, explosives, materials across the lake? You put it in the ferry. And then late at night when nobody's around, you just cart it across the street. And you store it in that ship. It was a derelict ship. It was called the Algo Bay. And ultimately it was owned by former Prime Minister Martin Shipping Company or some conglomerate related to it. Imagine that. And then people will go to these leaders and say, you know, there's a crook over there. This guy's no good. That guy's no good. This guy's no good. One thing I learned a long time ago when you're doing an investigation, they only want you to look down, generally at the downtrodden. Take them off to the who's gow and do whatever you want to them. Sell them, but from time to time you look across at someone at equal or equivalent rank. But never, ever, ever do you look up to find the real perpetrators, orchestrators, and manipulators of these heinous crimes. That they don't like too much. In fact, they don't like it at all. And then you end up like some of the greats in history that lose their breathing privileges over stuff. Because Mr. Fernandez was, great. President met him, and then all of a sudden everything's turned around, and he is sleeping under a bridge and found later. We were talking about Bill Cooper on the break, and, you know, maybe we can pick up a little bit there because you met Bill Cooper and have some interesting stories to tell about him and his revelations on 9/11.
Right, I do. I did meet Bill Cooper at a UFO show that he was at, he knew a lot about Area 51. Actually, used to do tours there, take people, select group, not a big group. And I have his book, Behold the Pale Horse. I think I have the 101st book. He signed it. And he had a hard, it was a hardback, but there was this shortback too you can get. And I was there with my wife and my oldest son, who was young, who was a little guy there. And he invited us back to his hotel room, which is right there, in the kind of a motel room. So I spent an hour with him in his room, talking to him and stuff.
mostly about probably Area 51. 9/11 hadn't happened yet, but right before it did happen, he made predictions. He said if something terrible happens in this country and the government starts pointing out to Osama bin Laden did it, don't believe it. You know, but there's more to it. He railed against the possibility as if it was going to happen. He knew it was going to happen. And I think about a month after 9/11, he was shot dead in his front yard or on his property by a sheriff's officer. They apparently had some warrant. I don't know if it was a bogus warrant, maybe for contempt of court, and but not showing up to court, you know, court date. And it must have been a gunfight. If there was a gunfight, and he was killed. So he was an outspoken hero in a lot of ways and predictor of what was coming down the pike. You know, as we talk about, and I mentioned before, George, I guess we were off air at the time, there is a, in his book, the Pale Horse, Behold the Pale Horse, there's a manual he includes that I had seen before that, but it's called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. And it's something that every American should really read. It's kind of startling. But a part of it, I'm just reading a little bit, if I could, and you cut me off when you want to, is it says, all science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. Beyond this remains only one issue. Who will be the beneficiary? In 1954, this was the issue of primary concern. Although the so-called moral issues were raised, in view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such a people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. So it goes on, the pamphlet goes on, and it talks about us being under attack, but we don't know it. And, you know, we could think, lots of times you don't realize you're being under attack because, I mean, we're being under attack by the quality of food we receive, the GMOs, and the air, and the chemtrails, vaccines, and a myriad of other things that we don't necessarily look at it being under attack, even the programming, the movies that we review and stuff like that, the messaging below the conscience level that we receive in the theater. But he says here, everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its own manner of functioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of chemical reaction or explosion, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. It makes no obvious explosive noise, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet, it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with the daily social life that is unmistakable to a observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help, do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. When a silent weapon is applied gradually to the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until this pressure, psychological via economic, becomes so great they crack up. Therefore, The silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their source of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. And I'll stop there. All right. You familiar with that, George?
Oh, by and large, I've danced in and through that quite a bit, because that's part of the nature of my spiel, is to deal with the most important facet of any struggle is the weapon against you, of course. You have to understand that. But one of the most important things on top of that is to know the enemy. And that's kept repressed so that we don't really understand the nature of the enemy as well. And if we knew the nature of the enemy, and if we understood the dynamics of their weapons, well, one, we wouldn't be lined up for the jab.
Yeah, well, that's right.
We would be in a consensus to go against this enemy and obliterate it from the social fabric of our society so that we don't have to deal with it anymore. I always mention Marshall McLuhan, the great media scientist at the University of Toronto, one of the greatest minds to come out of Canada. He was about 10 years before me, so I never had the privilege of really getting into his things, but I did do media with one of his last PhD students, and he caught me up to speed. But one of his sayings is, we live invested in an electric information environment that is quite as imperceptible to us as water is to a fish. And that's one of the big things we fight, is what I term artificial intelligence, robotics, the other form of life creature on this planet, the tree of knowledge, with us being the tree of life. And, it's obvious to me when many of these things happen what we're dealing with, but for most other people, it's just completely out there. When you mention 1954 and talking about how we're at war and we're herded and, basically inventoried like cattle and prisoners to the force winning the war, in July 12, 1952 was what they called the Washington merry-go-round, where, a bevy of UFOs circled the White House specifically, but in a two-week period then buzzed Washington all over. And it's my understanding that the superior force won, and we, to all intents and purposes, surrendered, and a treaty is alleged to have been signed in 1954 about this. And we have been on the subservient level, and that's pretty much the hidden hand, the deep state that's really running the world. A lot of it's described in Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. And so I see the enemy, I know the enemy, I see their weapons, I know their weapons. The challenging part is to tell the people who have been shot with them.
Yeah, well, listen, I've never heard that exactly what you just said as far as, us being under attack at the time. I guess it was. I mean, 1952, you said, I have to look at it. But there's a book that I was drawn to recently, and it was called The Final Events, and it's by Nick Redfern. I'm not finished it, but it goes into the UFO phenomenon, but it takes it to another level. And they talk about non-human entities, and they take it to a demonic level, that the whole UFO thing is a hallucination, in the sense that it's actually set up by these NHEs they talk about. And so it's kind of a fascinating book. Now, as president of the Lawyers Committee, we haven't taken a position on any of this stuff. What we've taken a position on is that the buildings came down in New York City, the high rises, because of controlled demolition and explosives. And we've taken the position that in the anthrax attack, the fellow that who was blamed for it by the FBI, Bruce Ivins, was innocent and was a scapegoat. And the FBI corrupted that investigation and obstructed it, and that they can't be investigated by the Justice Department, that Congress has to get involved, or has to, like a new 9/11 commission or a special counsel has to get involved, because they had criminal actions there in the anthrax. Now, all this other stuff I can talk about as a citizen, and I'm glad to, because I'm curious or interested in the things that you're saying and the subject matter that we're talking about.
Well, by and large, it's a free-for-all here, and you know, I was never aware of the Washington merry-go-round. I came across it inadvertently, and I'm going, wow, and a lot of people I knew who were in UFO lore and stuff like that never told me about that one. It's very well documented and researched. So what I did, I was supposed to interview Dr. Stanton Friedman on Roswell, and he passed away near my house before the interview, change in planes, and, you know, hopefully just of natural causes. But when I didn't have his book to read. He was leaving to go to Ohio, didn't have time to get me one. So I read the day after Roswell, and it was very, very clear that we were at war. And he describes the weapons and the battle very, very clearly, that there is a central entity computer involved, that silicon found on this craft is the life form, not the humanoid robots, which were genetically modified creatures. And we would spread that silicon around the world. It would become the World Wide Web and ultimately control and master us. And that was a giant slap in the face to wake me out of a deep sleep. And then I wrote a blog called The War of the Multiverse to realize that this has been going on since time immemorial, biblical times, long before biblical times. We have been struggling against this sort of force or entity. So I've got a book here that I was talking about in the first hour, and I mentioned Dr. Robert M. Wood, Alien Viruses, but his co-author is Nick Redfern, ironically. And
isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So, you know, he's mentioning that these retroviruses came from Roswell. And, you know, it's very, very fascinating material in there, because knowing where the murder weapon comes from helps you establish the criminal, to say the least.
Well, guess what? A colleague of ours, the Lawyers Committee, and a friend, Francis Boyle, he's been on some of our programs with the Lawyers Committee. He drafted the world's bioweapon treaty. He's a professor, attorney from the University of Illinois with degrees from Harvard. And he's like a world expert on bioweapons. And now back in January of 2020, he basically said this COVID was a bioweapon. And, you know, this point of the spike protein and all that stuff. He said it right from the beginning, and his YouTube was taken down shortly thereafter. But he's maintained that the whole time through, and he maintains it, too, with the vaccines. I mean, the vaccines are even worse than the COVID, right? Now, but to sort of like, you know, we're talking about sort of the end product here, George, when we're talking about what's behind this. And to get to what's behind it, you know, I look at this like it's a spiritual battle. And I guess if you look at it in a spiritual battle, the good and evil, you're looking at some kind of demonic forces, whether they be human. There was a question for me, whether they're extraterrestrial or interdimensional. All right. So what are they? But, you know, it might be as easy, not as easy, but as simple as in that pamphlet I was reading parts of, Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, the theoretical introduction is a quote, and this is maybe where it begins, in part: give me control over a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. And that was said by Mayor Amschel Rothschild. So if you're looking at the who controls the world, except, you know, it's not the Bill Gateses or the Jeff Bezoses or the Mark Zuckerbergs. They're like frontmen. It's what's behind that. And then you have to look at the lineage of the families and then what's behind them. And that's where it gets a little bit, you know, murky. But you can identify some of the, you know, those that aren't in the 99% of the world, right, and those who are in the upper echelons there. And I'm sure there's good people there, but I'm sure there's a lot of bad people there, too. And I think that maybe is one of the areas that you know, you could direct attention to and start making identifications there. And looking at the money situation, you know, Buckminster Fuller, he's a futurist. He created the geodesic domes and a lot of other things. But he said if you organize everything properly, we could all live not like millionaires, but like billionaires. So all this scarcity, this artificial stuff with regards to you know, poverty in the world, none of that has to exist. That's all crap. That's just to keep people confused and
disunited. And, you know, if we wanted to, as human beings, lift the level of society, we could do that. We'd have to have different motivations, though, different value systems than we have right now.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And a quick note on the anthrax is when I was doing research on that, I found out there was one of the victims, Robert Stevens, worked for AMI National Enquirer, and the editor's wife, Gloria Irish, rented an apartment in Delray Beach, Florida, where there was a little flight school for Marwan al-Shehi and Saeed al-Ghandi, more popularly remembered as 9/11 hijackers. And he may have had some of that inside scoop as well, and bought an early retirement ticket to paradise with another weapon that, who knows where the origins of that even come from. It's a very, very large dynamic we're up against here. It's just a resident evil that just has deep and total mastery of all around us, everything, cyberspace, space, and beyond. And, you know, we made a good connection with you, David, so, you know, we're very, very happy you could come and join us, and, you know, we can play some more and maybe start to do a little bit of a build-up to the 9/11 anniversary and, you know, just talk about two heroes in the past.
Well, listen, that'd be great, George. I'd like to come back. You know, we are planning a big event in New York City, so if any of your listeners are in the area or want to be in the area, we'll have some really great speakers, and you know, we're just setting it up right now. So maybe next time, if I come on again, I can tell you all the particulars and tell you who's speaking and you know, how it's all going to blow out. But it's pretty exciting. This marks the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Indeed, indeed. It's like a generation, and Power Hour was there through it all. You know, I remember Dave and Joyce just hammering away at 9/11 and hammering away for truth and justice in the American way, and to bring some sort of proper, decent closure to that event and put the perpetrators where they belong, behind bars, once and for all. God bless you all. Thank you very much, David, and till the next time.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.